Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. COVID isn't back. It never went away. What COVID is on the rise, and North Carolina is one of 27 states where detection of the coronavirus continues to surge to very high levels in wastewater. That's an indicator that more people are getting infected, and a new wave of COVID-19 infections has been seen this summer, driven largely by a new group of subvariants nicknamed FLIRT. The good news for us is the existence of vaccines that brought a pandemic to an end, with new versions being released to fight new variants of the virus. In fact, a new vaccine is due in just weeks. But COVID isn't the only virus that has medical experts concerned. We are also witnessing a rise in Mpox, in West Nile virus, and Eastern equine encephalitis, among other things. And as the anti-vaccine movement continues to fight science, that becomes worrisome. So we're going to spend this hour delving into all of this. Dr. Andy Pekosh is a professor in molecular microbiology and immunology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He joins us along with Dr. David Weber, professor of medicine, pediatrics, and epidemiology, and medical director of the Department of Infection Prevention at UNC Medical Center, and Jason DeBruin, his supervising editor for digital news and former health reporter for WUNC. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, good morning. So, Dr. Weber, let me talk to you first. Would it be accurate to say that most of us don't think much about COVID anymore, even though we probably know people who have contracted the COVID in the last couple of months? But now those cases seem to be much less worrisome than they were at the height of the pandemic, to put it mildly. Is that a healthy approach to take toward this virus, or are we kidding ourselves?
Well, I think the pandemic, as the large wave is over, but it does remain a continuing medical problem, and I think we need to be sensitive. You can't watch an evening newscast without seeing episodes of gun violence or car crashes, and yet we're still losing more people to COVID each year than either to car crashes or gun violence. Last year, we lost 50,000 people. So we do need to be attuned to the fact that COVID is not going away and does represent a risk, particularly for older individuals and for younger individuals with underlying disease. At UNC hospitals, in the last 3 weeks, we've had 6 deaths from COVID, and we're averaging more than 30 patients in the hospital each day.
You just answered my next question. Is it still does it still pose a threat to long-term health, and is it still life-threatening? Clearly it is. Put that 50,000 number you just referenced nationwide in terms of deaths from COVID, put that into some sort of context. Is that a large number? Is it a small number? Are there other diseases that are worse?
So the answer is yes. I mean, if you go back to 2020 and 2021 with our large COVID surges, COVID was ranked as the third leading cause of death after heart disease and cancer. It's fallen now, so it's around the 10th leading cause of death. So there are a number of other medical problems that it exceeds. But it's still higher, as I said, than car crashes and gun violence, and represents a major source of death in the U.S. In addition, as you know, a large percentage of people who get COVID, while they don't die, may go on to develop long COVID syndrome, which can last for months or years, with cardiac problems, problems with memory, less energy, fatigue. And this can occur at any age, although, again, it's more common in the older you are, the more severe disease you had and the more underlying diseases you had. But we have young people who acquire that as well.
And Dr. Pekosh, we talked a little bit about this before the program started, the fact that the CDC says that COVID-19 infections in North Carolina has grown. 27 states, we're among 27 states where they say our cases are growing or have grown, but now are likely declining. And yet the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services still shows high levels of the virus and bacteria linked to the virus in wastewater. How do you reconcile those two seemingly different forecasts?
Well, I think, you know, part of it is the total number of cases. And again, it certainly does seem like if there's a silver lining to where we are now with COVID-19, it's that the vast majority of people, when they do get infected, don't get sick enough to seek out medical care. And that gives us that surge of wastewater cases because wastewater really picks up the cases that are out there in the community, the people that don't seek out medical care. But you know, it's still very, very clear that across the country we're at very high levels of COVID-19, particularly given the fact that this is the summer and we weren't really expecting such a strong surge of cases in the summer. And we can't forget about the fact that the severe cases that are happening are really happening in very specific populations, elderly, people with secondary conditions. And anything that we can do to reduce the amount of COVID-19 cases is going to either directly or indirectly help those individuals stay healthy, particularly as we're waiting for the vaccines for this fall to roll out.
So when Dr. Weber refers to hospitalizations and deaths ongoing in North Carolina right now because of COVID, and you talk about the wastewater indicating that there are more cases of COVID than perhaps would present at a hospital or even to a doctor, there's a lot of COVID out there. That's what you're saying.
Absolutely.
So.
Again, the good part about it is that many of these cases are mild, but we still have a lot of cases out there.
And is it accurate to say then that these mRNA vaccines that were so quickly developed during the pandemic and which are responsible for bringing this pandemic under control, it also has mitigated the risk of COVID? People who have been vaccinated multiple times or who have had COVID have now allowed this virus to be endemic, but not always life-threatening. Would that be accurate?
Well, vaccination has helped reduce, particularly the severe cases. It's also helped reduce the total number of cases that are out there. Vaccines against respiratory viruses like COVID, like influenza, they're never perfect, like we hear with vaccines like polio or measles. A respiratory infection is a much, much harder thing to generate a vaccine against. But those vaccines are working. And certainly, when you also look at the hospitalization numbers, the vast majority of people in the hospital have not gotten a COVID vaccine update within, let's say, the last 12 months or so. So there's strong evidence that the vaccine does provide protection and certainly is being underutilized.
Jason De Bruin is with us. He is the supervising editor for Digital News and a former health reporter at WUNC and covered this extensively, I'm sure, during the pandemic. One way that viral levels are detected, and we've already talked about this a little bit, is through measuring or testing the wastewater. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services is seeing high levels of the virus in wastewater, particularly here in Charlotte at their checkpoint near Mallard Creek. I'm not sure how many checkpoints we have, but that's one that's showing high levels of COVID. What are officials saying about these instances, Jason, and how concerned should this make us?
Well, it should basically just let you know that you are very likely to come in contact with the virus. You know, when viral levels are low in any particular area or across the state, you know, maybe you won't come in contact with the virus if you're out grocery shopping, you know, at a family reunion, at a baseball game, whatever. You might just be less likely to actually come in contact with the virus. But when there's this much virus spreading across the entire state, which again, we've said it is, the data still show that it definitely is spreading at a large level across the state, you're just far more likely to actually come in contact with the virus. And so what that means, as you know, the medical professionals have already said, is that, you know, you need to protect yourself, because if you come in contact with the virus and you're not protected, you're more likely to get sick and more likely to get very sick. But, you know, if you're up to date on your vaccinations, if you take some simple precautions like washing your hands, even wearing a mask, if, you know, if you're comfortable with that, you're just far less likely that the virus, when you come in contact with it, will infect you or infect you in a, you know, in a very serious way.
And I think it was Dr. Prakash who said that it was surprising that we have such high levels in the summertime, because respiratory viruses generally proliferate in the colder climates when I think cold weather helps, but also our being indoors and not in the great open spaces that we are in the summertime. It seems to all respiratory viruses seem to be worse. So if we have high levels now, Jason, what are people saying about what might happen as the weather turns colder?
So that's a really good question. I will note that COVID actually has spiked in previous summers as well. It acts just slightly differently than what we're used to in, particularly in flu. So we have seen some of that summer spike of COVID that we would not generally expect from, say, flu as an example. One thing that maybe we can take a little bit of, I don't want to say hope, but some solace or perhaps in is that, now that we've had this big spike, you do sort of have this fresh round of built up immunity from people contracting the virus, right? And then now that the vaccine is coming available, this brand new vaccine that specifically protects against the newest strains, if people go ahead and get that vaccine, in September, October, perhaps we can mitigate and not see that big COVID spike in the winter months as we might have expected. Now, I don't mean to prognosticate anything. I am not crystal ball seer. We still have to do the right things, i.e. get vaccinated and take general protections and precautions. But it's certainly possible that because we've had this spike now at the end of summer, we might not see an additional spike, if that makes sense, in the winter months. Again, I don't want to go out and say everything's rosy. Everybody still needs to be careful, but it certainly is possible that we won't see it, this double spike, if you will.
So, Dr. Weber, since you talked earlier about increasing number, still having people in the hospital because of COVID infections, and some people still dying because of COVID infections in hospitals, and we're witnessing this rise in COVID in the wastewater, and yet the number of people in the hospital is not as high, certainly anywhere near where it was during the pandemic. What does that tell you?
So, if you look at the blood bank data, 98% plus of the population has some immunity, as was just mentioned, either by vaccines or by having had COVID in the past or by a combination of both. So that's what's mitigating it. And the new variants appear to be less severe disease as well. So, one of the things I will say, all the respiratory viruses survive better at low temperature, low humidity, and that's one of the reasons we see them in the winter. And as you mentioned, of course, we're indoors more, we have heating our houses, and it dries out the mucous membranes. But what's driving this summer surge, as past surges, is the new variant, which is the KP set of variants, so the flirt variants. That's what's driving it in the summer. And that seems to overwhelm the fact that viruses just don't survive and be transmitted as well. And yes, I think unless we see a new variant, the number of cases will fall, although we may see some bump, as we usually do around Thanksgiving and Christmas, with all the viruses as people are traveling and being in larger groups. A lot depends on whether we will see or not see a new variant. But the good news, as was already mentioned, is the two mRNA vaccines, which are now FDA approved, CDC recommended, and we do expect them to be available later this week or next week, are KP2 variant vaccines. And that's what we're seeing now, are the KP2 variants. So they should be quite active against that. And just today, the Novavax vaccine was approved by the FDA. Not yet, CDC hasn't weighed in yet. It's got a little earlier variant in it. It's a JN.1 variant, but the KP variants were derived from that. So I also expect it to have excellent activity. So that's the good news.
How many variants have we experienced since this virus presented itself en masse? Do we know? Do we have a count on that?
We do have counts. I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
There have been major variants, like this is these are all still Omicron variants, so you can follow the Greek letters there. But within Omicron, the subvariants, you don't get much protection even within the same overall class, like Omicron, Delta, or Beta, as these evolve into subvariants.
So when we come back, I want to talk about this flirt variant and why it's called flirt and what it is, and the possibility of a new variant, the XEC variant, coming sometime in the late part of this year or early part of next, and then vaccines, how they work, why they work, and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about COVID and other viruses that have presented themselves in our recent past, right now, as a matter of fact, with several experts on the topic. Jason DeBrun has covered this for a long time for WUNC as their former health reporter. He is now supervising editor for digital news there. Dr. David Weber is professor of medicine and medical director of the Department of Infection Prevention at UNC Medical Center. And Dr. Andy Prakash is a professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Dr. Prakash, this summer we've seen an increase in infections driven by this so-called FLIRT variant. That's uppercase FL, lowercase I, uppercase RT. First of all, explain that to me. Why the nickname? Why the spelling?
Well, you know, some people have gotten to calling variants by various names that really aren't related to what the variant does. FLIRT is interesting because it's actually, the name is based on the science. So there's a shorthand that scientists use for the mutations that viruses accumulate. And FLIRT variants accumulate an F to an L change and an R to a T change. So someone conveniently put a little I in between those two, and we actually have a rather catchy name for this current set of variants. But the science behind that is actually really interesting. We talk about FLIRT variants, and it's important to note that it's actually a family of variants, and these mutations are occurring in different variants in different places of the world all around the same time. So it's an amazing example of what we call convergent evolution, meaning that the virus seems to have sort of one path forward, and it's finding that path in multiple different places around the world. So it's a really interesting time for variants in terms of the evolution of that, because it's really telling us that these viruses are probably only have one or two directions forward to continue to spread in the population, but they're finding it, and they're finding it very frequently all around the world.
Let's talk about that for just a second, because it's a tendency for us to anthropomorphize these viruses. We don't think that they're thinking creatures. I don't know what they're, because they're not, I don't even know that they're living things, but their goal is to continue to live and proliferate without killing the host. So do these viruses tend to find ways to do that, to be less virulent in order to survive and spread while not killing the host that's keeping them alive, so to speak?
Yeah, all viruses want to do is transmit from one host to the next host. And what these FLIRT variants are telling us is that there's a particular way that the virus can get around the population immunity while still being able to transmit and infect people effectively, and that's by picking up these mutations. And so, yes, viruses don't think, but they do respond to selective pressure, and the pressure that that COVID viruses now have is really from that population immunity that's coming from both vaccines as well as from infection. Now, that's a good thing, because that same immunity is lessening disease severity, but it's also something that the viruses have to overcome if they are going to transmit to the next host.
So, Dr. Weber, does it hold water that as these viruses mutate, they become less virulent, less dangerous, weaker, or is that just happenstance? A new variant could pop up tomorrow that's far worse than the original.
So the answer is yes. It's hard to determine in part whether the new variants are just less likely to cause severe disease intrinsically, or as I already said, the majority of the population, the great majority, has some immunity from vaccines or natural disease or both. In many cases, many people have had multiple infections, giving you some immunity. So it's hard to sort of separate out the two. So yes, we could see a variant that is more deadly pop up. I think that's relatively less likely than just seeing continued variants that are more transmittable, since, of course, it doesn't do the virus any good if it kills its host and can't transmit. But I think we could, and we don't really know the time course for how rapidly these new variants will develop, but at least based on the whole pandemic, I think we will continue to see new variants. But the good news is, again, we can make mRNA vaccines particularly quite rapidly. And I'll note that you'll notice that CDC is calling this vaccine the 2024-2025 vaccine, as opposed to a specific name. And last year's was a 2023-2024 vaccine. So at least at the present time, it appears that we'll do the same thing as we do with flu, make a new vaccine each year that responds to the current variant, and that way provide better protection to the public.
Jason.
One thing I always like to add in these discussions, and partly it's because I've done a lot of reporting on people who have had long COVID, regardless of whether or not you've had, a severe infection, initial infection, let's say you maybe were just a little bit, had a little bit of malaise or whatever, you are still at a higher risk of getting long COVID. And that is something that you absolutely do not want. I've reported on former Clemson football players who couldn't even run a mile. I've reported on school teachers who were sleeping 20 hours per day. I had a sort of a distant colleague, an award-winning journalist who for months couldn't remember what she had for breakfast. These symptoms can sometimes stay with people for months, or as somebody even said earlier, years. And this is absolutely something that you do not want. So while it's definitely true that we are unlikely to see, hospitalizations at the level that we did 2 and 3 years ago, it is still so vital that people protect themselves, especially against long COVID, because that is something that can stay with people for a very long time and really debilitate. And I don't use that word lightly, debilitate some people if you get that. So, while things are looking better, especially from the initial infection, I very much want to always warn people to stay protected, especially because you do not want long COVID.
Dr. Prakash.
Yeah, and I also wanted to clarify that, we say mild COVID or COVID that doesn't result in you seeking medical care, but that doesn't mean it's not a pretty significant disease, right? Many people can be out of work for 2 or 3 days, can stay in bed, feel really terrible after infection. So even what we call mild COVID is a significant burden on people and on our society in general. So we're moving in a great direction, but again, we want to make sure that we have a realistic sense of the threat that COVID-19 has, not that we're justifying us not being able to think about it anymore because we don't think it's a problem.
Dr. Weber, do we understand why some people get long COVID and others do not, or even what long COVID really is?
So the answer is yes and no. We know some of the risk factors. The older you are, the more likely you are to get long COVID. The more severe your disease was at that particular episode, and the more underlying comorbidities like underlying heart disease, cancer, et cetera, all of those increase the risk. We don't really have an ex I mean, it's clearly immunologically based, but I don't know that we know the specifics there. I do want to make 2 points about long COVID, though. One is vaccines not only decrease the risk of getting hospitalized and severe disease, but they clearly decrease the risk if you get sick of getting long COVID. So that's another reason for getting vaccines. And two, I will mention that the University of North Carolina has the oldest and largest long COVID treatment center in North Carolina. And we're happy if some of your listeners do have long COVID, generally defined as having symptoms lasting more than 12 weeks, although that's really a consensus definition. But we're happy to see adolescents through older adults who have long COVID symptoms at our long COVID clinic.
One of the problems that we encountered during the height of the pandemic was that individuals, people, ordinary citizens, politicians, and medical experts were all trying to figure this out. They were all learning about COVID and how it worked and how it was passed and what it was in real time. So things, recommendations, guidelines, etc., changed periodically. So at first you were supposed to distance, then you and wash all your groceries, and then you weren't, and then you were supposed to wear masks, and that became very political over time. I know, Jason, that at one point the North Carolina legislature was considering banning wearing masks in public. Now that the pandemic is over, partly because they don't want people to commit crimes and not be able to identify them because they're wearing a mask. That was defeated. What, didn't they change their mind on that?
Maybe we'll have to find a political reporter, but I'm pretty sure that law actually is in place now and that you can be charged for wearing a mask in public. I think it's possible that it's connected. Well, again, you'll need to check me on this, but it's possible it's connected to protests, that the intention of the law was to be able to identify folks that are at protests that perhaps turn violent. Of course, there were some criticisms of that, saying that this law would be unequally policed, and that the intention was to only make it more burdensome for people to peacefully protest. I'll have to check that, okay. Though. I can do that quickly, actually.
Well, you get back to me on that if you have a moment. Dr. Weber, but is the recommendation from medical professionals, if you are concerned about catching this virus, if you have the virus, if you have comorbidities that make you susceptible to this virus, if age makes you more susceptible and you feel more comfortable wearing a mask when you go to the grocery store, should you?
The answer is absolutely yes. We did a number of studies along with one of our aerosol engineers, Professor William Bennett, and we did demonstrate that the surgical masks, medical masks, are quite effective of reducing the risk of acquiring COVID or other respiratory diseases. So they're not only protect you against COVID, they protect against the flu and RSV. And if you are sick and you need to go out, they're also quite effective in decreasing the amount of virus you expel into the air. So both are true. And the answer is yes. They're, I think, somebody who is particularly vulnerable by age or underlying disease of cancer should consider wearing a mask when they're in large groups outside of their house, particularly since the vaccines don't work as well in individuals who are highly immunocompromised.
I think Jason has an answer to the law concerning masking.
Yeah, so the law passed last session, was then vetoed by the governor, but earlier this year, meaning earlier in 2024, it was overridden by the legislature. So it is now illegal to wear masks in public. There's an exception for medical or surgical masks if the reason why you're wearing that mask is to prevent the spread of disease. So as we're talking about, obviously, right now. However, law enforcement are allowed to demand that you lower your mask for identification purposes, if they so need to. And the intention of the law was to try to reduce the number of masks worn specifically at protests in order for law enforcement to identify people at protests.
So masking is one way to protect yourself and others. The other way is to get vaccinated. And Dr. Prakash, the FDA greenlit three updated vaccines, the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna shots, and a third from Novavax, to protect people from these latest strains. Does that mean that flirt mutations or newer ones that are presenting this fall or later next year will be, you'll be protected against them through these vaccinations, these updates?
Yeah. The vaccine will never be a perfect match to what's circulating because we make a vaccine choice back in beginning of June, end of May, that locks the vaccine in place. But the virus, of course, doesn't care, and it continues to circulate and mutate and change in that intervening time. But we do know from laboratory experiments that both the JN.1 based vaccine that Novavax has and the KP.2 variant based vaccine that the mRNA is based on, both provide antibodies that cross-react with the current circulating variants. So they should provide protection, against, certainly against severe disease, and most likely against infection as well.
So the updated Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are mRNA-based, as were the original shots that were developed at the height of the pandemic. And the Novavax is based on older technology. It targets an earlier strain of this virus called, as you said, JN1. Who should get which, or does it matter?
Well, both should be effective. There are some individuals who are looking for the protein-based vaccine because there is some data suggesting that some of the side effects from the Novavax vaccine aren't as prevalent as with the mRNA vaccine. But really, both the mRNA-based vaccine and the protein vaccine work. You can look for if you have particular allergies against certain things, you can pick one versus the other. The Novavax vaccine is protein-based. It also has something called an adjuvant, which stimulates your immune response. So best thing to do is to touch base with your healthcare provider and make sure that you're not falling into one of those small groups that might prefer one versus the other. But otherwise, whatever's out there is going to help you reduce COVID-19 infection cases and your chances of getting severe disease. So you really should go out there and get whatever's available.
We have a Facebook comment from one of our listeners, Thomas, who says, I tested positive with COVID on July 21st, was prescribed Paxlovid, and had a visit to the hospital with an upper respiratory infection. The cough was horrible and finally started to feel better last week. As a person in their late 60s, the summer strain hit me hard, which leads me to this question, Dr. Weber. These new vaccines are out or coming out today or this week or next week. If you have never been vaccinated before, and whether or not you've ever had COVID before, can you start, should you start to be vaccinated with this new set of vaccines?
The simple answer is yes. The vaccines work, and you may need more than a single shot if you've never had COVID before, although the great majority of the population, 30, 40% of people who get COVID are asymptomatic, have no symptoms. But as we said, many people, like the person who was just on Facebook, do get severe symptoms. But I do want to point out one other thing we need to talk about that was just mentioned. We do have two oral therapies for COVID. Yep. And you've just listed one, Paxlovid. Molnupiravir is another one, and both are oral, but these are time limited. So again, for people who are older or underlying diseases, if they develop a respiratory infection, particularly now, about 20% of the people who have respiratory symptoms are testing positive for COVID. They should not say, well, let me see how I'm feeling in 3 or 4 or 5 days, because both of these oral drugs work best when started within 5 days. So first, you should test yourself. And I should say the tests are not very accurate, the over-counter test initially. If it's positive, you should call your healthcare provider, particularly if you have underlying diseases or you're older, and take one of these oral drugs. If you test negative on a home test, test yourself again on day 3 of illness. Many of them will turn positive by then. Or you could call your healthcare provider and get a PCR test, which is much more accurate and really doesn't have the same false negatives. And again, people have 5 days really to start those drugs. And I strongly recommend the at-risk group take one of those drugs.
I have, I think, 30 seconds. I don't know. But for those people who don't get vaccines, they don't believe in them. They question the science. They're afraid of them. They won't get them. Are the therapeutics as helpful? Can you come back from a serious infection with these therapeutics, or is your really only answer the vaccines? I have 30 seconds. Dr. Weber.
The best is the vaccine, because that's a prevention. It's always better. Prevention is always superior to treatment. The treatments are good, and we have treatments for sicker people in the hospital, but they're not a substitute for preventing it in the first place.
Dr. David Weber's with UNC Medical Center, Dr. Andy Prakash with Johns Hopkins, and Jason DeBruin with WUNC. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about COVID and other viruses and how to prevent getting them and the importance of being vaccinated, particularly against COVID, with Dr. Andy Prakash, Professor of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, Dr. David Weber, Professor of Medicine, Pediatrics, and Epidemiology, and a medical director in the Department of Infection Prevention at UNC Medical Center, and Jason DeBruin, supervising editor with WUNC, who has reported extensively on health news. Before I ask Jason a question, Dr. Prakash, KFF Health News, which used to be part of Kaiser Permanente, says that the formerly vaccinated and those who have previously been exposed to COVID might want to wait to get the new shots. Do you agree with that?
Well, the one reason that I would say you should wait to get the new COVID vaccine is if you've had an infection during this summer wave. If you've had an infection in, let's say, June, July, August, the immunity from that infection is really going to carry you probably out to 6 months from now in terms of providing some protection. So if you've been infected recently, you should probably wait to get the vaccine. But I'm not a big proponent of timing the market when it comes to vaccines. My attitude is, even if you get vaccinated now, your protection should carry you through the presumed winter wave. And so it's best to make a concerted effort, go out there and get not only your COVID vaccine, but your flu vaccine, and if you're eligible, the RSV vaccine sometime soon, because again, these will come back this coming fall. And studies have shown that if you try to space them out, many people never go back for the second or the third one because, well, they get busy and a trip to the pharmacy or your medical provider is sometimes not the highest thing on your priority list when people get busy.
And getting the vaccine, Dr. Weber, is no guarantee that you won't get COVID, just as getting the flu shot is no guarantee you won't get the flu. What does it do for you, however? Does it just lower your chances of getting serious infection if, in fact, you do get it?
Well, I'll start off in saying it's like seatbelts. You know, if you're wearing your seatbelt and you get into a 75-mile-an-hour crash head-on, it may not save you. But overwhelmingly, the benefits are to always be wearing seatbelts. And the vaccines are the same way. There's no guarantee with them. They're better preventing death than serious illness, and better preventing serious illness than just infection. But they do ameliorate the illness. They do reduce the risk of long COVID, and they've saved hundreds of thousands to millions of people worldwide. So I strongly recommend it. I'll also say you can get the vaccines together if you want. You can get COVID, flu, and RSV when those shots become available. Flu shots are already available, RSV shortly, and COVID shortly. So you can get all three at the same time if you would like, although some people will want to get only two at once there. And the RSV is only recommended for really older individuals.
Couldn't they put them together in the same shot so one needle stick is all you need to get?
Well, the answer is yes. And okay. Not available yet, but the companies, Moderna, Pfizer, and others, are hard at work at making combined flu and a COVID vaccine. And they're not going to be ready, the bad news is, for this winter season. But I do expect that the next winter season, we will see combined flu COVID vaccines. I've already seen data. It's been published on their phase two trials. And they both, the vaccines by those companies, demonstrate they give you equally good protection when in the same shot as they would separately. So they will be available next year.
Dr. Prakash.
And I will say there's also a lot of research going on what I would call a second generation of both COVID and flu vaccines, which the aim is to provide broader protection and longer protection to try to avoid those annual vaccines. So, you know, right now we have good vaccines, a lot of research going on to try to make them even better at protecting from infection and severe disease.
So, Jason, COVID is a strange intersection of medicine and politics. And I know that you spent a long time covering medical developments and health news for WUNC. And I know you're not the political reporter there, but I have to ask you a politics question, and maybe you can answer it, maybe you can't. These life-saving vaccines were developed at the height of the pandemic, which ultimately brought it under control. And it happened all on Donald Trump's watch. He could have easily taken credit for the vaccines and urged his followers to get vaccines. For whatever reason, he did not, though his criticisms of Dr. Anthony Fauci and others fed the distrust of the science behind these vaccines and a distrust in health experts in general. So what might a second Trump presidency mean for public health and for future pandemics?
Well, you know, I think a lot of experts, a lot of onlookers have said that it could be very troublesome, right? I mean, as you noted, the vaccine was developed very quickly in record time under the Trump administration and then wasn't pushed maybe as strongly as it could be by that administration that frankly did a good job in developing that vaccine. You know, I think that how the Trump administration handled the pandemic left a little bit to be desired. And I think there could be some concerns, and I think there are concerns that if there is another health emergency, even if it's not to the level of you know, COVID-19, literally a worldwide pandemic, that it could not be as strong or as good as maybe another response could be. And ultimately what that means is more people getting sick and, of course, more people ultimately dying. And I think that's the, you know, that's what we have to always remember, is that lives could have been saved by a better public health response. Lives could have been saved by a more responsible response from a personal level from a lot of different people. And we might again see that we lose lives unnecessarily, we the United States or even the whole world, if a response to a future public health crisis is not as science-based, fact-based as it could be.
Dr. Weber, let me ask you a political question, a semi-political question. We learned last week that Mark Zuckerberg, the chairman and CEO of Meta, the company behind Facebook and Instagram, said in a letter to the House Judiciary Committee that his teams were, quote, pressured by the Biden White House to censor some content around the COVID-19 pandemic. He wrote, quote, in 2021, senior officials from the Biden administration, including the White House, repeatedly pressured our teams for months to censor certain COVID-19 content, including humor and satire, and expressed a lot of frustration with our teams when we didn't agree. That's a quote. And he called that approach wrong, and he came to regret that his company was not more outspoken about fighting back against the Biden administration. President Biden initially commented that social media platforms at the time were killing people with information. He later walked that back, but U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy said at the time that misinformation was a serious threat to public health. As someone who deals with the infection prevention at UNC, what's your take on this? Is censorship of misinformation about public health permissible in a society where the First Amendment reigns?
So I think I believe in complete transparency of scientific information. So as papers come out that are scientifically valid, they should be disseminated and they should be discussed, and all of that, all the data should be available. That said, as with many other things in life, misinformation is dangerous. You don't want to tell people it's okay to go out in a thunderstorm, take a metal ladder and climb up to your roof. That would be dangerous. It's not a good idea to be playing golf on a course with metal clubs, and that would be dangerous. It's not a good idea to jump into a pool if you don't know how to swim. So misinformation can injure people. And I think that we need to label it as not scientifically correct. It should still be out there. But I think that's incumbent upon all of us in news media and in science to label things that are scientifically inaccurate as such, but to be completely transparent about scientifically valid data. Do vaccines have potential harms? Yes. Do the benefits greatly exceed the harms? Yes. I'll give you an example in terms of myocarditis. It has been reported as a side effect of some of the mRNA vaccines. That said and done, the risk of myocarditis after you have natural COVID or flu for that matter is much higher than from the vaccine. So again, complete transparency. We want to talk about the harms and let people make a proper decision. But we also have to be careful about not putting out information that is objectively false. Vaccines don't cause autism, period. That's been repeatedly demonstrated in huge studies, and we need the people to understand that this is not a harm from vaccines, and I think it is incumbent upon all of us to give the public the correct information.
Jason, did you want to get in on that?
Oh, sorry, no, I wasn't raising my hand.
Okay.
I might add, though, a little bit of news you can use. Tests are coming available again, COVID tests. So the rapid tests are going to be disseminated by the federal government again. And so if you think that you've been infected, this is maybe a little bit of a tricky situation for a lot of people. And I'll even just sort of speak as sort of the layperson on the panel here. It can be embarrassing if you think that you have COVID-19, right? I mean, if you think that you're responsible and you're trying to avoid it and then you perhaps contract it, it can be a little bit embarrassing. And so you maybe want to not tell a lot of people that maybe you've infected them, because that really could, again, be kind of embarrassing. It's important to take that personal responsibility, test yourself to see if you've been infected. And if you are showing positive, let people know who you've recently been in touch with. And please do not go to out in public, or certainly don't go visit your family. Again, this can mean that you skip a beach trip, or that even Thanksgiving perhaps coming up, or that just that you skip a weekend with grandma and grandpa.
Yeah,
it can be uncomfortable, and it really can sort of upend your social calendar a little bit. And that really is, I hate that, But please do take some personal responsibility and stay away from other people if, you know, if you're showing that those two lines.
I want to get a quick answer to this next question because I want to move on very quickly before we run out of time to West Nile and some of the other viruses that are being spread this summer. We have a comment from one of our listeners on Facebook, Michelle, who says lots of rare cancers have come about during the COVID pandemic. Most cases, individuals had COVID disease and early immunizations. Can you talk about any new data and relationship between COVID disease, immunizations, and these rare cancers? So, Dr. Prakash, is there a relationship? Do you know about this? What can you say?
Yeah, I've not seen any data to support cancers coming from particularly people who are early and immunized early in that. I think that the vaccines themselves, again, this is an important point that Dr. Weber made as well. We sometimes think the mRNA vaccines are new. They're not new. They've been studied for more than 20 years and developed to be particularly effective in human populations. And the COVID vaccines are probably the most studied vaccine ever produced in the history of humanity. And what that means is we can track down to very rare adverse effects because we have such good science that's been done on the vaccines. And again, the vast majority of studies, virtually all credible studies, really point to an incredibly strong safety record, an incredibly strong efficacy record. And when there have been adverse effects, like again, like Dr. Weber said, when you look at COVID-infected people, oftentimes the signals there are even stronger than in vaccinated individuals.
And I want to point out something you just referred to, that people are suspicious of these mRNA vaccines, the initial vaccines that were released for COVID, because they happened so quickly. They didn't trust them because they thought it hadn't been studied. And in fact, they've been studying them for years. And that's the reason they were able to develop them so quickly, because the technology had been in place. It had been used. It had been studied for decades. We've been hearing about mosquito-borne viruses this summer, Jason, and disease outbreaks of West Nile virus and Eastern equine encephalitis virus in many parts of the country. What is the situation here in North Carolina?
You know, that's a good question. I've not parsed those data, certainly not to the level of what we're seeing in COVID recently, right? I mean, so with, maybe to put a little context on it, be careful for all of these diseases, right? All of these viruses, we don't want any of them, but certainly those are not spreading nearly to the levels of COVID-19 or even the flu.
And we're also hearing, Dr. Prakash, this summer about mpox, which used to be called monkeypox, a virus that's on the rise in many parts of the world. Are these new viruses coming to us in this part of the world because mosquitoes are hitching rides on cargo ships and coming here from other parts of the world? Is it because of international travel? Is it due to climate change? Why is this happening?
Well, with mpox, it certainly seems like there's an outbreak of a particularly of a more virulent strain of the virus that has been growing in case numbers and across large swaths of Central Africa. And now we're seeing travel in and out of Africa bring that virus into other areas. Certainly when it comes to mosquito-borne diseases, there are a lot of data suggesting that climate change does affect the range of mosquitoes. But in infections like West Nile virus and equine encephalitis virus, Eastern equine encephalitis virus, are here in the United States. Depending on where you live, there's a relative risk for you to acquire those. And I should also mention that all three of those diseases, we know very clearly how they're spread, and therefore you can get very clear guidance as to how to lower your risk of getting those infections, even though the risk already is quite low.
Would that just be staying away from mosquitoes in the case of West Nile and equine encephalitis, or and mpox? I know is spread through personal contact in many cases. Correct?
Exactly. Use of insecticides or deterrents is one of the main things that people should be aware of these days, especially as we're going back outside.
So I have less than a minute left, Dr. Weber. Are you seeing instances of mpox or West Nile or Eastern equine encephalitis presenting in North Carolina?
So the answer is we do have occasional cases of those viral Eastern equine and lacrosse, particularly in the western part of the state, but we've not seen any here at UNC yet.
Are there therapeutics or vaccines to protect you against those?
Not for humans. We have some animal vaccines that protect horses against Eastern equine encephalitis, but none for humans. And it's such an uncommon disease, only about 10 cases a year, that we wouldn't immunize humans.
Dr. David Weber is professor of medicine, pediatrics, and epidemiology, and medical director of the Department of Infection Prevention at UNC Medical Center. Dr. Anti Prakash, professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. And Jason DeBruin, supervising editor of digital news at WUNC. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.